The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Hi, thanks for inviting me. It's been 20 years since I've been on this campus, and I see I would have been in your place, just 20 years back. And I know the problems that history teachers actually face when teaching history to undergrads, you know, like y'all. And I thought I'd propose a lecture, a special lecture for y'all, just to kind of give a global perspective on things. Usually, you're taught history as some people, some buildings, some places, and somehow the interconnections are just lost. And I can tell you how some of the maps would look. Is to your left is a map of Iran, and these are how national history is actually written. What is outside of the borders is a complete abyss. It's black. And to your right is what you would call like a religious history, is like an expansion of domains, political domains. And you have no idea of what is happening outside of this. Again, it's black. We get some clues in a book by Mark Kurlansky called Salt, World History. It is a book, as the name suggests, completely about salt, from the preservation of mummies and the pickling of vegetables in ancient Egypt to Gandhi's salt march in Gujarat as a demonstration against colonial taxes. It is only about salt. The anecdotes are fun to read, and it successfully makes connections across cultures just by telling stories about salt. The world seems a much smaller space. People seem more alike. Their physiological and transcendental connections with salt are no longer local, but enmeshed in the economic, scientific, political, religious, and culinary occupations of the world. In short, it's making connections through anecdotes, maybe, but it's making connections. To the right is A Global History of Architecture by Ching, Jazombek, and Prakash, which also focuses on seeing connections, tensions, and associations in a similar way. They call it synchrony. So when things actually happen simultaneously around the world, it's not just a matter of coincidence. It's part of a larger scheme of architectural development. That somehow hints towards a better way of looking at history, beyond the stigmatizing discourses on nations and things like that. You'll be wondering, I'm going to spend 40 minutes talking about bricks. I'll just like to justify that. The brick is a global thing. It's surely the most common building material in the world, and since almost every geographical region in the world has adopted it during some phase in history, it promises to make a great global history. So just like salt, it has a kind of a universal use. And I will talk about bricks, and if other things come up, we can talk about those. So obviously, I'm not the first. Brick, A World History by James W.P. Campbell provides great insights into the use of brick in all its forms. Mud bricks, baked bricks, glazed bricks, terracotta, shaped bricks, as well as bricklaying techniques and brick production throughout history. Of course, he's an Englishman, and he kind of climaxes on the Renaissance. So in some way, I'd like to extend his study to kind of incorporate things that happen maybe in China. I kind of needed some authority on my introduction, and who better than Lutyens? He's well known for building amazing brick houses in England, and he also happened to build the imperial capital complex in Delhi. A short walk around Mass Ave would kind of start you off on this journey, and I think I don't want to point out the details right now, but if you can just start keeping some details in mind, you'll start making connections through the lecture. So this is the Ashdown House, and it's the lobby. I remember 20 years back, I used to practice my mountain climbing on this wall, and these are basically these deformed bricks that are kind of embedded into this wall, and of course the inside too is extremely beautiful. This is by Eero Saarinen. So you can start seeing patterns, and of course this requires, this is called the herringbone pattern, and this requires a lot of skill. Obviously this one has kind of caved in some way. This is Hi-Fi Pizza. You wouldn't have noticed the building above, but it's quite remarkable. It's got some pretty beautiful details there. And keep these in mind for sure. So this is terracotta. I'm wondering if you can start writing back. I mean, writing a history for this. I mean, how did things get here? Some kind of a movement of technology, and I think that's what I'm more interested in kind of sharing this kind of a global history with you. So, what I'll start with is the first brick. These were essentially hand molded, and they were just mud and water, and they kind of resemble these pieces of dough. And the ones at the bottom actually have some finger impressions marked in it. Why do you make bricks? Why not just construct in mud? There are some reasons. The first reason, and probably the most important one, would be transport. Is that it's tougher to transport mud than transport brick. As far as you need some kind of formwork to actually fill mud in and then compact it, brick, of course, comes kind of made, if especially like this. The first bricks were actually found in Neolithic Jericho, 8,300 BC. So this is old. I moved to the River Valley civilizations and their use of brick. I would define brick in its widest sense, incorporating pottery and terracotta, and I mean taking in as much as things that are made of mud and then baked or sun-dried or just molded in hand. These yellow patches are they didn't settle here to make bricks. I want to make that very clear. So the River Valley had other things to offer. It wasn't the bricks. And of course, the Banpo is, I'm sure, kind of surprising. It normally doesn't come under the genesis of brick. And this was interesting. And it had one of the most advanced kilns for the time. And I'd like you all to keep that in mind for the rest of the lecture, because somehow China keeps producing very interesting baked products well-fired throughout history. And it kind of stays a little aloof from this kind of a mass that will keep growing throughout the lecture. 1500 BC, the image on top is a wall painting, and it shows the process of the brick making. And they obviously used, they kind of evolved into using molds for the bricks. And these were sun-dried, so they had mud, water, and grass, and they kind of mix them up and set them in what you see as the mold. This is so. Why don't I just locate this? This would be the Mesopotamian angle. So they developed four different kinds of bricks in this time, and they were. This is a ziggurat, so they were basically mounds of bricks. But they also managed to develop molded bricks. Now, these would actually be constructed on a large scale. They'd be set up on the floor. They actually designed as a complete panel, and then fired separately. So it is quite an elaborate method. This is again another settlement between Iran and Afghanistan. There can also be patterns made in mud bricks, and this one, of course, is something related to the palm tree. They probably had some kind of iconic kind of connection there, and it has a very a stark elevation. This is the great temple of Rima. And we come to the Indus-Wari civilization. This is a pic of Mohenjo-daro. What actually remains in these ruins are actually baked bricks and just heaps of mud bricks. What you find is bathrooms, gutters, public baths, graves, things that you'd build in baked brick. So there's a certain importance assigned to baked brick in this time, which kind of tells on how much effort was actually involved in making the bricks. So there was at some point in 3000 BC. Baked brick was 30 times more expensive than mud brick. So, and there have also been studies involving the Indus, where they actually said that fired brick was a product of urban specialists. So this was already some kind of an industry building up here, and it kind of required certain political economies that produce these bricks. When we come to 1000 BC, there's a kind of a surge in Mesopotamia, and the Aryan kind of descent into the Ganges Valley. Again, this is still restricted to river valleys, and though not too much remains of the Ganges, of the Aryan temples built in this period. I just wanted to briefly indicate the Greek Empire, and its contribution to this study is basically the roof tiles, and apart from that, it doesn't really expand these yellow patches basically for the study. So in a way, studies that are focused primarily on some kind of material aspects kind of overlook certain other histories. And some civilizations just don't appeal in their brickness. This is Babylon. The first signs of glazed brick, of course, used very extensively. This is also laid out on as a panel, and then glazed, and then baked separately. In this period, there's a little, this is 400 BC, and this would be when Buddhism just gave a little push to brickwork in East India. And of course, China in this time. Okay, so we move into 200 BC, which is the expansion of the Roman Empire, and in China we see the dynasty actually starting to build the Great Wall of China, and so this is Rome. Technology is taken to a whole other limit. The use of the concreted wall and here in Rome, the industry actually builds up to the point that it can mass manufacture for an empire this large. I mean, it's expanding right north of the entire Africa, and you have most of Europe taken in, and of course it gets all the way to England. And we see the transference of certain Greek details into terracotta, into brick, into kind of cut brick. And this is an interesting point where you can actually see certain technologies being invented to suit transition in some way. And here again, I'd just like to bring to your notice that the cornice actually, as in Greek architecture, the cornice is again extremely important for the brickwork in Rome as well. And the use of corbelling is used. This is an example of a brick kiln in Rome. They say that there were even coal kilns. I mean, that would kind of justify their rapid expansion and their production of brick at such large scales. Their standard types were the one right at the bottom was actually 2 feet by 2 feet, and that was their standard tile that they used. This was the Roman brick, and the ones above are actually special bricks used for other reasons. This is the Great Wall of China, actually. This is a time. The black outline in this map actually indicates how far the Buddhist Empire actually did go at this time, and but it again does not really affect the brick history as yet. So China still remains a little kind of producing terracotta soldiers, the terracotta army, and this kind of a whole different brickwork, while the Sasanians actually take on this a whole new a new style for brickwork. This is an example of a fire temple, and this is just the extents of the Sasanian Empire. There's a flamboyance in structural use of brick, and of course as ornament as to it's used extensively. These are the terracotta warriors in China, and I mean these are thousands and thousands of them. So this is actually it's like a they're actually working on kind of a parallel technology in some way. This 600 CE is when we actually we start seeing the fragmentation of the Roman Empire, and it's two arms, one the Byzantine and the other the Ravenna, and there's also then a surge in Bengal at this time. I put this map here just to kind of clarify certain things, is that what actually is missing in this one. So I actually place this in just to kind of give you all a reference in some way of where all the empires actually had extended in some way. And you see the Europe is completely fragmented there, and of course the Umayyads have taken over the entire, I mean the first expansion of Islam. And we see the complete difference between the two styles actually. In to the left is actually the Byzantine, and to the right is the Ravenna style, and there's a certain solidity that is associated with the Ravenna style, which actually continues through in Italy, and while the use of more flamboyant, more slender arches actually are actually used in the Byzantine Empire. We see the emergence of the dogtooth pattern here. You can see it in the top left photograph, and you can see the towards the roof. It's actually lined with the dogtooth pattern, and that would be the one on the left here, left bottom. And as a comparison, just between the left and the right, you can actually see the kind of differences between the two styles, one much more solid and the one on the left actually more flamboyant in that way. There's also a kind of creation of terracotta as a facade material. This is actually the little splurge of when Buddhism and Hinduism actually found some kind of a confluence in eastern central India, and these are the few surviving brick temples in the region, and these are of course they are completely cut brick, and when we come to 900 CE, the Abbasids have kind of have already lost their empire, which extended all of that green, and the Samanids actually are a group close to the Caspian, which are actually developing this very intense technology on decorative brickwork, and we see this the Ganges Valley again dotted with these brick temples at this time. This is actually just an enamel kind of an enamel decoration on a chest, which actually shows some kind of a confluence between the Roman and the Islamic. So actually, what I want to talk about is the smooth transition between from the Roman to the Islamic, and this whole and we'll see it how it's actually played out in these different buildings around the Islamic Empire. So these are actually the early mosques built by the Abbasids, and we see it in Sevilla, where a certain adaptation of the slightly more flamboyant style is actually made out, and you see it in Kairouan as well. The dome is actually created by eight arches, so that in a kind of a Roman method. This is, I think, one of the most blatant examples of the transfer of the most smooth transfer from the Roman to the Islamic, and this would be this is in Toledo in Spain, and we see the arches, which are again they're dumb arches in some way, and it's something that will keep repeating in Islamic architecture of this time, especially that which overlaps with the Roman Empire. So in some way there's this whole kind of no apprehension to adapting, to appropriating. The transition just seems to be extremely smooth in that way. And this, of course, is the tomb of the Samanids. It's a beautiful building. This is the area near the Caspian, actually, which I was talking about, which actually develops its own way of decorative masonry. In this building, the bricks are not really special bricks. They're almost the same cuboidal bricks that you get today. It is purely in the brick laying that you find the decorative brick masonry as a craft. And of course there are the same kind of signs for some kind of a development from Sasanian and Roman. So there's a kind of combination here in this region. These are some of the bonds which are actually which are just beautiful. I mean, just this. And then of course that entire area develops its style from here. This is a minaret built in almost the same kind of a pattern and technology also. So you see the same the fourth band from the bottom actually has those circles, and you can find those similar circular special bricks in this mosque, in this tomb as well, at the top. And this was the little flourish between in central and eastern India. This is Nalanda University. Again, made of brick, and at this time there's a proliferation of stupas that actually go out made of brick. This is now getting to where I would be more interested in the study, is the emergence of Pagan in Burma, and some kind of a parallel similar decorative masonry in the by the Seljuk Turks. And this is an interesting time because the central region between them is actually occupied by other political parties. And this would be a little hypothetical, but it is worth proposing in the sense of when we actually see some kind of a terracotta facing, which is adapted in some way to the Islamic motif and things like that. And this is of course proliferated through the use of certain forms. Robert Hillenbrand, an Islamic scholar, actually theorizes this in the sense that he talks about it in the sense of that a certain amount of mosques were already built in these regions, and the idea of spreading identity, in some way religious identity, was actually adopted by these other buildings, which were the minaret and the tomb. And these are tombs that actually proliferate from Iran during the Seljuk Turks, and they reach all the way till Aswan, Egypt. And of course, these tombs are they carry the same kind of patterns that were persistent in the Caspian area. This is Isfahan. This is the Great Mosque at Isfahan, and the entire linear route that leads to the main mosque is the Market Street, and each of the domes is actually built in a different pattern. So you have a complete, and I'm just showing an example at the right hand bottom here, of how these patterns actually were used in this dome construction, by vaulting, of course. This is in Ardistan. This is again the Seljuk Turks. In England, this is a little later. Sorry. In Burma, I was talking about the Pagan Empire, and this actually stretched the entire height of Burma. And this was along the river Irrawaddy, and the empire is about 400 years old, but it sees some kind of a proliferation of decorative brickwork at this time, and it's interesting to kind of see the references of this empire of Pagan with respect to the Seljuk Turks as well as China, in the sense that it actually adopts the terracotta kind of the terracotta wares that make some kind of reference to both regions. And this is of course a time when the entire area is global, and these connections are very possible of this kind of a transfer of technology. 1200, we see the lower kind of the African route actually connecting back to the Nile and Italy producing maintaining its production of decorative brickwork and England as well. We see the first building built out of Roman bricks, and this is a continuation of some kind of a tradition, kind of a technology of construction. So this is Italy. This Siena. The idea of the guild is actually building up at this time, when certain groups of masons were actually getting together and producing and making buildings completely. So this is in Multan, close to Pakistan, now in Pakistan. So this is all, again, the same Iranian technologies extended. I kind of end at the 1450 when I think tracking brick loses. I lost complete control of tracking brick at this time. It's when all medieval cities were being built, and every medieval city was built out of brick, with the black outline, I just give a rough impression of where these cities actually were being built in some way. We see fortification, and of course these are now details that you can start seeing here as well in the real estate building and things like that. So this is where actually certain medieval fort-like constructions were propagated, some kind of a decorative brick masonry. This is in England. These are again special bricks. They are the complete design is seen first, and then the bricks are actually molded and then placed to form this kind of a pattern. Around the 1600s, we also see a propagation of the pigeon tower or the dovecote as carrying decorative brick masonry on it, and this goes all the way to England, north of France, Germany. Completely, it fills up all of Iran. So this kind of a form, which is actually carrying a very secular form, carrying the pattern brick masonry. I keep this one in the sense that I'd like to talk about pattern brick masonry as some kind of a branding, in the sense of branding of empire, if that's possible, in the sense that a complete set of public institutions are actually built in pattern brick masonry. So how you can actually recognize an architect's work, maybe in the city you can actually point out to a Gehry building or something like that. In that sense, this actually has a kind of a sense of branding in the way that it's extremely recognizable. I see four regions actually in the 1600s as developing their characteristic decorative brick masonry. One is Bengal, the other is Italy, England, and Iran. So these are kind of four pockets which are actually extremely connected through the buildings that I've just shown you. And I'd like to take one thread through, and that would be Bengal. These are pre-Mughal empire. This is the pre-Mughal sultanate in Bengal of Gaud and Hazrat Pandua. And you can see these are, of course, completely ruined. You can just see the few patterns and the terracotta works in this picture. The mosques. This is the Eklaki Mausoleum. Again, it's the proliferation of the tomb as the carrier of, and these images are actually reminiscent of the Aswan tombs and it's and the Pagan and this kind of the plan is a chamber, and it's a very solid structure, decorated brickwork, and This is a very high level of terracotta facing in these works. And these mosques, well, there are two stories for these mosques. One is that they actually plundered the pagan temples and the Buddhist temples in the area and actually used the terracotta for the mosques. Or, of course, a more global explanation would be that the craftsmen were just there. And this kind of just a blurring of boundaries and the movement of craftsmen can actually facilitate architecture like this. And this moves very smoothly into, these are temples, these are Hindu temples. And in Vishnupur again, Bengal. And again, they have the same kind of a tomb-like character to them. And you can see the whole, the transference of from Buddhist to Islamic and to Hindu and kind of a religious integration. And we end up with a 19th century settlement in Bengal, which is again built in brick. This is just one settlement, and then the there are accounts of the river changing course, and this is actually the entire delta region of the Ganges. So the river keeps changing course in that sense. The importance of cities also kind of depends on that. Later in the 19th century, decorative brick masonry actually gets into international expositions as representative of some kind of identity. It is put into manuals, into these are some of the first houses built. Not on the left is actually the one of the first houses built in America, and this would be, of course, the New England kind of a house. And the one on the right is in DC. These are again carry forward of some kind of pattern brick masonry, which finds a complex route through England. And more recent, we have Antonio Gaudi, who kind of worked with all kinds of decorative brickwork in the sense of special bricks and terracotta, deformed bricks, tiles, in that sense. Even more recent, Frank Lloyd Wright and Louis Kahn. And we also have the Monadnock building in Chicago. And certain sensibility about making the plinth carries forward through certain examples, which I did not show y'all, Frank Lloyd Wright kind of emphasizes the horizontal in some way, and you can see his vertical joints are flush with the brick, and his horizontal are actually recessed in some way, so you actually catch horizontal lines as shadows. These were also used in Roman brickwork long before. Iran, of course, this is recent work, an Aga Khan Award winner, and it actually kind of uses decorative brick masonry as an identity. As a national identity now. It reflects in miniatures, it reflects in the architecture as well. I'll just end with the works of Laurie Baker in Kerala, India. And he being called the poor man's architect. So the actually brickwork starts in the developing nations, starts to kind of respond to the financial conditions and basically the general economy of the and of course making beautiful buildings within a certain economy. He uses the thinnest wall possible, which is just half of the brick size, and of course the stability is got through certain geometries of arches and plan and things like that. This is a girls' hostel. And I'll just end on a note on which is slightly more technology based, in the sense that we've kind of passed the stage of doing this, and our kilns have definitely kind of evolved into this. At the right hand bottom is actually what our modern brick making factory would look like, and the possibilities of creating any kind of brick of any color and any size and any consistency, and just the fact that the potential of decorative brick masonry even today. Thank you.